The Guardian.
The Guardian Books Podcast with Claire Armistead.
Hello. This week we're going to talk all about self, in particular how and why some writers can't resist putting themselves into their own books. When I raised the subject on Twitter, it prompted some debate as to what the name for this trope was. Is it autofiction or, God help us, self-insertion? My two guests might have some views on this, but whatever you call it, it sounds like this.
For nearly a decade, Lindbergh was as great a hero in our neighborhood as he was everywhere else. The completion of his 33-and-a-half-hour non-stop solo flight from Long Island to Paris in the tiny monoplane, the Spirit of St. Louis, even happened to coincide with the day, in the spring of 1927, that my mother discovered herself to be pregnant with my older brother.
All I knew of Jewish people was that they paid father very much currency in order to make vacations from America to Ukraine. But then I met Jonathan Safran Foer, and I will tell you, he is not having shit between his brains. He is an ingenious Jew.
Walk properly, Edgar, she would say. You want me to leave you behind? Don't think I wouldn't. Oh, you foolish boy, who do you think I'm doing this for? You grow out of things as soon as I put them on. Do you know how lucky we are to have a few dollars? Other children were cast-offs, and they're happy to have them.
So, how does it feel, he asked, to be part of someone else's story? Well, I'm not sure, I answered, choosing my words with care. It's going to take some getting used to, I think. Then, with a sinking feeling, already knowing what the answer would be, I asked, does this book of yours involve toothbrushes by any chance? And Donald Crowhurst?
Some examples there which you may like to pit your wits against and try to identify. Appropriately enough, our featured author this week is actually called Self, Will Self, of that ilk. His new book, Walking to Hollywood, is a characteristically lively and unorthodox blend of fiction and non-fiction. Here's an excerpt.
Next victim. Can he seriously mean me? This fat and fertiloquent young man, his cheeks dimpled by silver studs, his black dungarees wide as an army tent, his moobs silicon stiff beneath the gothic fluting of his top shirt. I said next goddamn victim. I'm among the chocodiles and the donuts, athwart the snowballs and the cherry slices, all tangled up in the gummy worms and the sour neon worms. I'm a pedo, cruising the Sour Patch Kids, with a gummy bear on my arm. I can't make change for this. He snaps my 20 in front of his miserable face like a small green clapperboard. Yet here, at the counter, in the gas station a couple of miles along Century Boulevard from the airport, it isn't the beginning of this scene at all. Oh boy, you're going to regret that. I deliver my line with edible insouciance, the calm before Carly comes, forearms whirling, double jaws snapping, skull necklace clacking. Excuse me? I now have both Rivet Cheek's attention and that of his colleague, a blameless Hispanic kid whose slick hair is teased and trimmed into all manner of points. Before answering, I take a bottle of Powerade from a cooler, crack the screw cap, ostentatiously down the entire 20 fluid ounces, then burp. I say, you're going to regret being impolite to me, because now I will be compelled to shove all those Starlight mints, candy corns, baseballs, Twinkies, peach slices, ding-dongs, and especially, I turned to point at the bottom of the display rack, Dunkin' sticks, right up your fucking arsehole, before employing your friend's greasy head as a plunger with which to pump up the resulting sugary muck into an artery-busting froth. Reflecting on the incident later, as I lay across my bed in the Ukbar Inn, I realized it was the greasy that had cost me the sympathy of the other customers in the gas station, who, hitherto merely restless nobodies, now asserted themselves as dangerously individualist frontiersmen and women. With 6 months still to go until polling day, the wind of change was starting to blow away the nuage maritime of the Bush administration, so that any racial tokenism that may have been lingering in the body politic was also purged. But at the time, I responded purely to the filmic grammar. Not, I hasten to add, that CGI can possess syntactic clarity, uttering as it does only the same proposition again and again. We cannot, dull clay that we are, ever fully suspend disbelief in the physics of mass, and so, fingers coated in slip, we spin the wheel. But first, in advance of the arse-stuffing, I run out onto Century Boulevard, straight into the traffic stream, and stand there, arm outstretched, palm raised, daring the next vehicle, which happens to be a passenger bus, fully laden with newly landed Japanese tourists, to run me over. It does.
As you can gather, that is actually sort of fiction, otherwise we might not have Will Self reading it to us. It's the sort of thing a psychiatrist might want to have a word with him about, and that was the role Richard Lee took on when he went to meet him at his home in London.
The best thing is if you can bear to say hello to me. We'll go upstairs, all of you. Come on, Meg.
So, Mr. Self, or can I call you Will?
I welcome the deference, but yes.
That's very kind of you. Are you comfortable there on your couch?
It's not the ottoman I'm used to, but it'll do. It came from World of Sofas.
Can we start with this book you've written, which appears to be a sort of diary of three recent episodes? Can I begin by asking where the idea came from to turn away from fiction and to examine your own experiences in writing?
I can't remember who it was who said that all writers are either voyeurs or egotists. I think inevitably for writers in middle age, there is a sense that the observed life is over-observed and there's nothing much happening in it. And therefore, ineluctably, the idea arises that one should, as it were, write about the observing of the life in that way. So it's a kind of recursion in that sense.
This wasn't the idea of one of your therapists?
My therapists have tolerated rather than encouraged my work over the years. There's been a degree of confabulation. Zach Busner, who, you know, I've been in therapy with on and off since my late teens, has appeared in a number of my books as a character. I've appeared in a number of his articles in the British Journal of Ephemera, normally, you know, in his investigations and papers on schizophreniform disorders of one kind or another. But I wouldn't say that he's ever viewed my writing as therapeutic, particularly.
It's a very grim vision. It's sometimes almost horrific. Do you think it's part of the writer's job to hold up a mirror to society and reflect the shitness of the world?
What we call the crap force, in fact, which, as Schopenhauer observed, is almost in opposition to the life force. I don't know what the writer's job is. I suspect that these memoirs, these peripatetic memoirs, come rather out of the fact that writers don't have a job, in fact, and therefore are compelled to anatomise themselves.
Is it perhaps a tactic to avoid the problem that you identify with Hollywood films, whereby Hollywood films reflect the shitness of the world around them by a lack of quality?
I'm very taken by the way in which computer-generated special effects have enabled big production Hollywood movies to make suspension of disbelief, in a sense, effortless. Back in the day, even with movies in the last millennium, if you wanted to try and get a viewer to imagine they were in the insect mines of Minroad or they were inside somebody's liver, it was still a stretch of the imagination. But nowadays it can just be done. And I thought it would be interesting using a much more primitive narrative technique, prose fiction, to try and deconstruct a lot of these CGI sequences. So
Walking to Hollywood is studded with these rather literary descriptions of rather fantastical things. Either that, or they were in fact real psychotic interludes.
Walking to Hollywood blurs the lines between fact and fiction. There's the fantastical nature of much of the action, but there's the paraphernalia of non-fiction, the footnotes, the pictures. Is it something that you set off to write a piece of non-fiction and the fiction intruded?
I don't know. I'm quite surprised by the book. I wrote the book backwards. So I wrote Spurnhead, the last piece about walking from Flamborough Head to Spurnhead on the East Yorkshire coast, I wrote first. And my methodology for that was very strange. I wrote it first before I did the walk. And then I did the walk. And then only changed what, you know, only interpolated, you know, as it were, factual episodes that I thought would
that fit the mood you already had.
Yeah, would fit the mood I already had. So the whole methodology was very odd. With Walking to Hollywood, I did the walk, pretty much as it is in the book. I walked from my house here in Stockwell in South London to Pinewood Studios near Uxbridge, had a chat with Daniel Craig on the set of Quantum of Solace, the new Bond movie, walked on to Heathrow, flew to Los Angeles, to LAX, and then embarked from there on a 120-mile circumambulation of the Los Angeles basin. So that's all as is. I had intended, I think, to write something fairly essayistic. I was very concerned with this idea of the kind of the death of film, the idea that film is no longer this dominant narrative medium, this kind of, you know, to use the Stendhalian phrase, it's no longer the kind of mirror within which humanity regards itself in quite the same way. It's fractured, it's split up. But I got back and I couldn't actually say the things I wanted to say in an essayistic form. I certainly didn't want to write a travelogue. I wasn't interested in that. And so the piece took shape around the demands of the things I needed to say in that way. And then with very little, the first part of the book, which is more of a meditation, even though it follows this rather odd kind of book tour of the States and Canada in November of 2007, again, there were very much things I wanted to say. There were meditations on scale, the meaning of scale and distortions of scale in the satiric and in the artistic that naturally found their expression in the form the piece ultimately takes.
You seem very mistrustful of this whole idea that you can write a memoir, reconstruct it out of your head. If you're so mistrustful of this idea, why not just write another novel?
I think you could reasonably say that Walking to Hollywood is a novel. I don't think you could. For me, all good fiction is a psychic autobiography anyway. You know, you learn far more about a writer by reading the fiction. And what I've always noticed as a writer of fiction is that the things that were most revelatory of myself just pass people by. You know, I know it's all there in the fiction anyway. So in a sense, doing something like this, which seems to be incredibly exposing, it's like hiding. It's like when a child kind of covers its eyes and imagines it can't be seen. That's what I think fiction is like anyway.
So this is hiding in plain sight.
Hiding in plain sight.
So that's why this Will Self, who isn't you in these pages, that's what he's doing there, is he? Is he giving you cover?
He is me. I mean, that's me. I mean, all of his responses are my responses. That's me.
Well, I think that's all we've got time for. So shall we say same time again next week?
Yes, let's say same time again next week. And may I remind you that my bill is outstanding.
Richard Lee talking there to the voyeuristic, or should that be egotistical, Will Self. Walking to Hollywood is just out from Bloomsbury. With us here in the studio today is novelist and essayist Adam Thirlwell, and of course our own Sarah Crown, editor of the Guardian Books website. Welcome both of you.
Hi.
Sarah, just let's stick with Will for a moment. Is he breaking new territory in this?
For him, I think it's new territory, yes. It feels like a sort of a diversion for him from his usual fictional short fiction, all the stuff in his journalism that we're used to reading from him. This is a different arena.
Mm-hmm. Adam, he's actually presumably quite deliberately placing himself in Sebald territory, isn't he? I mean, there's something... He sees himself as part of a grand tradition. It's not absolutely about discovering himself walking, is it?
Yeah, certainly Will is a huge admirer of Sebald, and Sebald is certainly one of the most kind of prominent contemporary writers who use this essayistic crossover with the novel, where the novelist writes in their own kind of voice, and so you're never quite sure what's fiction and what's fact.
And we're talking about things like Rings of Saturn.
Yeah, so yeah. Where he kind of walks around Norfolk and Suffolk. And I think that the difference, I suppose, here, though, is that Will is doing something quite fantastical at the same time. With Sebald, there is a blurring between what's obviously going to be true and what might be made up, but the kind of zany antics of Will Self's kind of prose and his imagination and are very far from Sebald. And in fact, I think it then goes back to a kind of huge European tradition. I mean, it goes back almost as far as Rabelais or someone who speaks in the first person, but then uses that to then come up with kind of crazy anecdotes. And it's almost as if by speaking your own person, you allow yourself this freedom to then make up even more improbable things. Mm-hmm. And although I think it's kind of this kind of tradition of this kind of selfish fiction, of using kind of the self in fiction, is seen as slightly, I think, by English readers a lot as a foreign kind of entity. I think actually to a lot of Europeans, this would be seen as a massively English invention because it goes back to Laurence Sterne.
We'll come back to that in a little bit. We're going to move now from sort of cross-genre writing that Will Self is involved in to straight fiction. And I'm aware that that's a mine about to explode in my face. There certainly, Sarah, seems to be a trend at the moment among novelists for putting themselves in the frame, as well as you've got Will Self. You've got Michel Houellebecq, who's done it in his latest novel, La Carte et le Territoire, I think that's how you pronounce it, which will presumably be called The Map and the Territory when it eventually makes it into English. And Alberto Manguel, the Canadian-Argentinian writer, has also just done it in his latest novel, All Men Are Liars. So, Adam, you mentioned it maybe being a foreign tick. Is that the case?
No, not really, because there are obviously English novelists. I mean, Martin Amis puts himself in Money. And so it's not a purely foreign thing. I mean, I suppose really what it comes down to is a certain type of experimentation with the novel and an experiment with whether a novel is true or not. And I think one tradition which has obviously kind of won slightly in Britain is the idea that in order to convince a reader of a story's truth, you, the narrator, keep out of it. And so you use this kind of third-person narrative voice, which has become the sort of standard by which other fiction is now judged. And I think this is a little sad, and it might be that, therefore, in European fiction, there is a little bit more enthusiasm or kind of experimentation with ways of sort of breaking down that contract between the reader and the writer and changing it. And one way of doing that is to introduce either the eye of the novelist speaking or to introduce the novelist by their own name.
Now, you mentioned Martin Amis's Money, and I just happen to have a little bit of Martin Amis reading from that very offending passage, which actually so enraged his father, Kingsley, that he threw the book across the room when he read it.
I was just sitting there, not staring, not even breathing, like the pub's pet reptile, when who should sit down opposite me but that guy, Martin Amis, the writer. He had a glass of wine and a cigarette, also a book, a paperback. It looked quite serious. So did he, in a way. Small, compact, wears his rug fairly long. The pub's two doors were open in the hot night. That seems to be the deal in the early summer. Tepid days and hot nights. It's a riot. Anything goes.
Martin Amis there. Now, Kingsley Amis regarded this as, in Martin's words, buggering about with the audience. And Martin himself almost immediately abandoned it as one of the dead ends of postmodernism. Now, you mentioned the grand tradition that it comes to. We started to talk about that a bit, Adam. Let's go on. You know, you're tracing it right back to Rabelais and then, for, and you know, then Cervantes as well.
It seems to me that with Amis using it, it's a bit more like kind of those paintings sort of where Carpaccio or something, some Venetian painting where they simply put themselves in a kind of crowd scene. I don't really think it's massively breaking any fourth wall by having a kind of this small kind of moment of Amis introduced into the narrative. There seems to be much kind of bigger playfulnesses going on. I mean, I suppose the central modernist one is Proust's A la Recherche, where the narrator is called Marcel. And this allows him such a kind of strange freedom so that at the same time, this is a sort of panoptic novel of society at the time. But by using his kind of own voice, he can allow himself some kind of self-exposure that almost, I think, if it were in the third person, wouldn't be possible. So, yeah, so this line kind of runs through Proust. Then I think in the 20th century it becomes quite prevalent. There's kind of Robert Musil in The Man Without Qualities who uses his own narrative voice to sort of write little essays around his characters. And I suppose that tradition ends up in Milan Kundera. And I mean, I think one novel that where this is interesting is The Book of Lart and Forgetting, which includes seeming memoir within the novel of Kundera's time in communist Prague. And it also includes quite sort of horrifying anecdotes, including one about a meeting, a secret meeting he has to have with a friend of his who has just been interrogated, and they have to kind of check their story. And because the girl is so scared, she keeps going to the toilet. And then Kundera makes this extraordinary admission where he says there was something about her vulnerability that made me want to rape her at that point. And I think that if you do a thought experiment and imagine that as a third-person narrative, it would just feel utterly sort of annoying to the reader, I think. And it would seem willed and over the top in its seeming desire to shock. As it is by narrated by Kundera, it feels like an extremely raw and quite terrifying piece of self-exposure. And so this thing that looks tricksy actually becomes very emotional.
Does he actually identify himself by name in that novel?
Not by name, it's just the I.
Right. Let's just go back to first principles, and we're talking about two different things here. There are two strands, rather. One is writers writing themselves in as characters in a sort of generic sense, but the other is where they actually mention their own names, which is what so enraged Kingsley Amis about Money. Sarah, it is nearly always men who do this, isn't it?
Yes, we've been talking about him, and it really does seem to tend to be a male trick to play, I guess, which makes it sound more negative than I think it is. I know that there are several women in French literature who've done this. The one woman I could think of writing in English who's done it is Gertrude Stein, who wrote the autobiography of Alice B. Toklas. The thing is, it's so tricky, this one, because she calls it an autobiography of her partner, Alice B. Toklas. Obviously, it's written by her, so if anything, it's a biography. She's actually in it as a character, and in fact, it's a novel anyway, so it becomes this incredibly Byzantine piece of writing. And then there's also, sort of more recently, Penelope Lively does it to a certain extent in her book Making It Up, which is sort of a series of short stories about key points in her life when things might have gone in a different direction, and she follows the other direction. But then that's a slightly different thing, because she's doing it in this very particular context of being clear that she's fictionalising her own life. She's not just inserting herself in as a character into her fiction. So again, it's a very interesting thing that she's doing, but it's not quite exactly perhaps what we're talking about, of just the novelist turning up as a character in their own work, which seems to be something different.
Well, this particular tick earned Jonathan Coe a very stern telling off earlier this year from the critic Alex Clark, who wrote of the terrible privacy of Maxwell Sim. By the end of the novel, we will also have witnessed a disastrous appearance by the author himself, provoking us only to wonder why novelists ever think this is a good idea. Let's just listen to what happens when Maxwell Sim meets Jonathan Coe on a beach in Australia.
So, how does it feel, he asked, to be part of someone else's story? Well, I'm not sure, I answered, choosing my words with care. It's going to take some getting used to, I think. Then, with a sinking feeling, already knowing what the answer would be, I asked, does this book of yours involve toothbrushes, by any chance? And Donald Crowhurst? Well, funnily enough, said the writer, it involves both of those things. I wanted the story to revolve around a household object, one that people use every day, without really thinking about the political or environmental implications. Well, I had trouble coming up with anything suitable in the end, and actually, it was my wife who suggested toothbrushes, and shortly after that, I was having coffee in London with my friend Laura, who's an art critic, and she started telling me about these works by Tacitus Deen that were inspired by the Donald Crowhurst story, and she also put me onto this brilliant book about him by Nicholas Tomlin and Ron Hall. So, you see, what generally happens, to answer your original question, is that I get all sorts of different ideas from all sorts of different places, and when I start putting them together, other things start to emerge. People, to be precise. Characters. Or in this particular instance, he looked at me. You.
Of course, what the hapless Maxwell hasn't quite realised yet is the full extent of Jonathan Coe's murderous intentions. Now, Sarah, this is a novelist taking the plot by the scruff of the neck. This is surely unusual, isn't it?
This is probably quite unusual. It felt to me that this instance of Jonathan Coe coming into the novel was a bit like Martin Amis and Money, actually. He just kind of pops in, although in this case he has more of a say over what happens next. Like Alex Clark suggested, it has sort of smacks of Deus Ex Machina a bit, except that he's the Deus. So he sort of swoops in, and obviously that's what a writer is anyway. So he's just kind of realising that fact of writing, I suppose. But generally, yes, as a rule, they tend to be observers rather than motivators when they crop up in
And they're quite
books.
Often dorks, aren't they? I mean, I know in the Welbeck, he appears in La Carte et le Territoire as a smelly, friendless, alcoholic misanthropist with a grudge against the media. Actually, it's not so far from the truth, is it, Adam?
No, not at all. A perfectly reasonable self-description.
There's also another trope that runs in parallel here, which is of writers who use an alter ego. Philip Roth does both.
For nearly a decade, Lindbergh was as great a hero in our neighborhood as he was everywhere else. The completion of his 33.5-hour nonstop solo flight from Long Island to Paris in the tiny monoplane, the Spirit of St. Louis, even happened to coincide with the day, in the spring of 1927, that my mother discovered herself to be pregnant with my older brother. As a consequence, the young aviator, whose daring had thrilled America and the world, and whose achievement bespoke a future of unimaginable aeronautical progress, came to occupy a special niche in the gallery of family anecdotes that generate a child's first cohesive mythology. The mystery of pregnancy and the heroism of Lindbergh combined to give a distinction bordering on the divine to my very own mother, for whom nothing less than a global annunciation had accompanied the incarnation of her first child. Sandy would later record this moment with a drawing illustrating the juxtaposition of those two splendid events. In the drawing, completed at the age of 9 and smacking inadvertently of Soviet poster art, Sandy envisioned her miles from our house amid a joyous crowd on the corner of Broad and Market. A slender young woman of 23 with dark hair and a smile that is all robust delight, she is surprisingly on her own and wearing her floral-patterned kitchen apron at the intersection of the city's two busiest thoroughfares. One hand spread wide across the front of the apron, while with the other, she alone in the crowd is pointing skyward to the Spirit of St. Louis, passing visibly above downtown Newark at precisely the moment she comes to realize that, in a feat no less triumphant for a mortal than Lindbergh's, she has conceived Sanford Roth.
So there we have Roth invoking himself in the plot against America. But he also, of course, appears as the wrinkled retainer Nathan Zuckerman. Sarah, can you just explain what the difference is between these two ticks?
This is the absolute nub of the whole thing, because Philip Roth is the perfect example. He does everything, and this is what shows that this isn't just an author fictionalising his own life. So with Roth, we have him doing, on the one hand, I Married a Communist, which is very, very thinly veiled autobiography of his marriage to Claire Bloom, and she's very recognisable in it as her daughter. But that book is starring Nathan Zuckerman, who is Roth. But then if you look at a book like The Plot Against America, which we heard a reading from before, that stars one Philip Roth, who is much less like our Philip Roth, because The Plot Against America is an alternative history. It's complete fiction. Then you have a book like Operation Shylock, written by the author Philip Roth, which stars Philip Roth, who is battling against another Philip Roth, his nemesis, who's over in Israel trying to bring all the Jews back out of Israel again. By doing this, he's really sort of pushing us, I think, as his readers. And the great thing about Roth is that the more of it you read, the more it builds up and up and up until you get kind of completely sucked into this universe where you don't know what's what. And it's incredibly powerful and interesting when he does it. My slight concern is that when other writers do it, it can end up being a bit faddy.
Adam, as a novelist yourself, is this something you're tempted to do? You have what you call the big eye, don't you, in your writing?
Yeah, I found that my two novels, I always start in the third person and always end up interrupting so much that it becomes a novel by me. And I think it is to do with what's at stake. And I think that it's only interesting when you feel that you've made it more dangerous for yourself as a novelist to include yourself in this way.
Talk about politics. Just explain how that happened.
So in politics, basically, this novel about a kind of ménage à trois, about this kind of these three kids kind of falling in and out of love together, what I enjoyed about being able to kind of write as a kind of version of me, partly it means you can say things that are kind of outrageous and outlandish, that somehow you've got more freedom to do them in an I, which therefore you can say is fictional, than if you were in the third person. And it also allowed sort of the introduction of much more disparate material. It means that you can be much more digressive and much more sort of, I don't know, kind of trying to write about everything. I always quite like writing a novel that tries to include the whole world. And in some way, I think that therefore using the I, the kind of essayistic I in a novel, helps that. I mean, but also I think it is to do with kind of trying to almost make a novel more truthful. And there's a strange sort of ethics to it, I think, that it almost feels like you're being more honest in exposing yourself sort of more that way. That sometimes I feel when I read a third-person novel and there's a sort of random moralistic sort of generalisation that somehow free-floats kind of neither between the characters. Sometimes I feel like that kind of writer should just own up to that's their generalisation about life rather than something that emerges from the narrative.
Is this all about getting won over the sort of social realist novel?
I don't think it's about getting one over. I think it's certainly about finding more interesting things to do sometimes than... I think all good fiction is trying to reinvent the form of the novel. I think that's something that has always kind of intrigued me is how would you make something feel more true but by potentially being more playful? I mean, a novel that I keep thinking about actually is Pushkin's Eugene Onegin, this novel in verse that was hugely indebted to Tristram Shandy. And the real interest for me, I think, is that Pushkin puts himself in it as a friend of Onegin. And so he says, yeah, I'd like you to introduce you to this friend of mine. He then has a lovely bit where he says that actually a friend of a friend met him at a party. He's actually rather fallen out of kind of touch with Eugene, doesn't really see him anymore. And so it's this beautiful kind of blurring of kind of, and you don't quite know at what level of the kind of fictional game to place this eye. And there's a lovely anecdote that Pushkin kind of sketched a drawing of himself standing, looking at the River Neva in St. Petersburg, of him and kind of Eugene Onegin together. And that seems to me a rather nice symbol of trying to sort of materialise the novel to say, either you believe that this is me, in which case you have to believe that Onegin is a true person rather than a character, or if you kind of are persisting in thinking that Onegin is a character, then you don't believe in my existence either. It's a point where kind of you try and deconstruct realism to such a point that actually it's as if you have some higher reality you're kind of believing in. I mean, the great writer for this is Nabokov, who keeps on stashing away little kind of anagrams of himself or butterfly hunters who are not named, and it's obviously meant to be him. And it's partly with Nabokov, all this playing around with fictional reality, it's because he's a genuine mystic, and he believed that we were all being stage managed by a higher kind of power, and that therefore art was just a kind of simulacrum of this. And so the kind of deus ex machina you're talking about is entirely kind of apt there, where basically he's kind of just saying you have to kind of realise that therefore you might be being at this moment written by somebody else, just as these characters are being written quite obviously by me. So Panin, he actually includes his own name, but not his full name. So it's Vladimir Vladimirovich, seems to be the narrator of Panin, and therefore seems to be Nabokov. But since Nabokov is never named as a surname, you can never quite kind of be sure. And it seems to me that that slippage, it looks tricksy. And I agree that certainly it can be faddish if it's used, I think, without being thought through. I think if it doesn't become sort of structural, it can be a bit dull, I think, and kind of just sort of reflex almost.
It brings us to what J.M. Coetzee, in I think it was in Summertime, described as deforming the medium. And he described it, actually, he criticised himself for not doing it, it within this sort of fictionalised autobiography. So we've come full circle there, back to the Selfian fictional non-fiction. It's a huge subject to tackle in 30 minutes. Martin Amis, however, thinks it's all passé. And of course, as I said earlier, his father never liked the idea in the first place.
Yeah, well, he read the first long chapter that was in Granta. He hadn't been a great fan of mine to date, but he said, it looks longish. He said, it's going to be longish, right? And I said, yeah. And he seemed more enthused than usual. Then my mother told me that despite her standing over him with a knife, he tossed the book aside on the page 87 that you've just earmarked.
And that was particularly because of you bringing yourself into the picture.
Exactly. It was a postmodernist intrusion that he characterised as buggering about with the reader, where, you know, different levels of reality and, you know, letting the reader into the innards of the book in a way that he always disapproved of.
And is that something you might do now, or have you grown out of it?
I think the novel's grown out of it. Postmodernism was the literary movement of tremendous predictive power, in that the world is very postmodern as we look at it, in that politicians, it's like the Pompidou building in Paris, where you have all the plumbing and the air conditioning on the outside. You know, you show the world what you're up to as an architect. And the novel tried to do that for a while. I don't think it led anywhere much. There are a couple of masterpieces like Philip Roth's The Counterlife, you'd have to say Don DeLillo, White Noise, where postmodernist spirit is rampant and productive, but otherwise it was disappearing up your own backside. That was the tendency, and so it didn't last long. I was just trying to see if there were any comic possibilities there.
So is Martin Amis right? Is he merely dated? Or is he just talking of his own particular experience? We know lots of you listeners will have your own opinions, so please do join the discussion on the front page of this podcast on guardian.co.uk/bookspodcast. And we'll send some selfish books to the first five people who can identify the books and authors that we have quoted on this podcast. And that's it for this week. Thanks to Sarah and Adam in the studio, Will Self and Richard Lee on the couch, and Chris Moran and Jim Falzerano for the readings. Will Self will be back on Saturday in Guardian Review, squaring up with three other contestants to the hardest exam in the world, the entrance test at All Souls College, Oxford. Adam, I believe you've passed this one, have you?
Long ago, I passed
it. In your youth.
In my youth.
Do tune in again next week when we will be quizzing the political commentators Polly Toynbee and Will Hutton about their latest books on the state of the nation. I'm Claire Armistead and the producer is Tim Mabey. Goodbye.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.